The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Welcome. My name is Michael Toms. Our guest for today is an American shaman, a visionary for our times. Perhaps more than any other single person, he has been the great popularizer of myth for everyone. How each of us recreates the legends of the past in the here and now of our daily life. He is the author of many books, among which are The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Masks of God, Myths to Live By, The Mythic Image. He edited The Portable Jung. Having spent some 35 years as a professor at Sarah Lawrence College, he now travels the world sharing his wisdom in his own wonderfully mythical manner. His name, Joseph Campbell, and today we're going to be exploring the enchanting and revealing myths of the past, the present, and the future with Joe Campbell. We're glad you're with us on the journey, and we'll be here for 2 hours. Joseph, it's nice being with you again.
Well, Michael, it's always a pleasure for me to be with you, and I've been looking forward to this two-hour session for some time.
You know, Joseph, some people say that we live in a time of transformation, that the time for transforming is now. But as all history, people talked about living in a time of transformation. And I know that, you know, alchemy comes out of the myths of the past, and alchemy had to do with transformation. And I'd love to hear you talk about how transformation has been with us since the dawn of time.
Well, there are certain periods when the transformation is quite special and extremely radical, and ours is certainly one of those. When you realize that the culture of the world since about 3000 BC has been mainly an agrarian culture world with city life, and it became fixed in its character very, very early and remained fixed in its character up to the coming of the Industrial Revolution. And look now at the world and see those older societies disintegrating under the impact of this really tremendous new thing. And think also of the fact that most of the early civilizations lived in relative isolation with a horizon that they controlled, and people within that horizon having essentially the same experiences. And see now that these horizons are all smashed and people of totally alien kind coming into collision with each other. This is a period of transformation in a big, big way. And anything from the past, like an idea of what man of this, that, or another culture might be or should be, is now archaic. And the transformation is really of the whole sense of humanity and what it means to be a cultured and world-related human being. It's a whole new thing. And so we have to, all of us, leave our little provincial stories behind. They may guide us as far as structuring our lives for the moment, but we must always be ready to drop them and to grab the new experience as it comes along and interpret it.
You know, one of these new experiences is the idea of moving into space, moving beyond the planet Earth, and we're hearing talk of space colonies, and UFOs have been around now for some 20 years in the media anyway. And I'm thinking of the currency of several popular movies dealing with the theme of other beings and so forth. Is this something that's gone through our past as human beings, as having contact with other beings?
Well, I have a little thought about that. Our own mythology of the creation of man and all of that is of such a kind that we think of the breath of life as having come from without. God breathed life into the earth. On the other hand, there are systems where we feel, where it is thought, that man is himself a product of the earth, you know, the child of the earth, the fulfillment of the earth. We are of the earth, and the earth has brought forth its people, so that we are, as it were, the thinking, the seeing, the hearing, the loving of the earth itself, as though we were an organ of this planet. Well, now with this notion of all of the inspiration coming from outside, you see, I think that is what makes us watchful of people coming from other planets. And when people speak of civilizations on this planet as having been established by visitants from afar long, long ago, this all speaks of we don't have it in us. Somehow it has to come to us. I think that's one of the myths that has to be thrown away, that we are the children of the earth, we are the eyes of the earth, the spirit of the earth, the bouquet of the earth, and it's right here that we've got to find our salvations and changes, and also appreciate what we've already done.
So things like the pyramids and, like, think of the plains of Nazca and such stupendous undertakings, you feel that were done here on Earth by people living on Earth.
Exactly, yes. Also, I'm very much interested in the early history of civilizations and mythologies, because that's where all of our mythologies really originate, in old times. We don't have the mythology for today yet, for this new kind of world that's coming along. And when people try to interpret in terms of sunken islands and all that kind of thing, you know, the Atlantis and the Lemuria and Mu and all of that, I think, again, that is a way of discrediting the actual historical possibilities that we're becoming more and more intimately aware of with the great progress in archaeology lately.
Is it possible that civilizations existed prior to when we think they existed? I mean, the usual slant is that we evolved as creatures, and it's hard to, we don't never hear very much about civilizations existing perhaps 500,000 years ago. Is that in the realm of possibility from your studies? And
well, when you realize what 500,000 years ago was, that's the period between the Mindel and Riss glaciations, and there were no Homo sapiens on Earth at that time. It was Homo erectus, the type that we have in Pithecanthropus, and there's no sign of any possibility of a civilization. It's really very crude Stone Age still. So how this other thing could have possibly come about at that period, I just can't imagine.
So you think that we only really go back perhaps 15, 20,000 years as far as the civilization as we understand it? How far back?
Oh, well, the lines are pretty clear, although they keep moving back as new discoveries come in. But Homo sapiens, the kind of human beings we are, come in around 30,000 B.C. with Cro-Magnon man, but he's still a Stone Age man. Now, we're beginning to realize that there were developments in Southeast Asia, the discoveries that have been made in northern Thailand, a place called Ban Chiang, and around there, point out that a movement toward agricultural domestication of plants and also domestication of animals and the development of bronze and iron took place down there much earlier than we imagined. But the classical reading is that somewhere around 9,000 B.C., 9,000, that's not a long time ago when you consider 500,000, which you've just mentioned, about that time, domestication of animals and domestication of plants began to develop in Southwest Asia, what we now call the Near East. And then it takes 6,000 years for anything like a city to emerge in that context. And the cities did emerge in the Mesopotamian area between Tigris-Euphrates around 3500 B.C. And those are the first cities in the history of the world. And it begins to look more and more as though certainly the cities in the Old World are all from that seed. There is a diffusion then of city civilization out toward China, itself, where it arrived somewhere around 1500 B.C., a good deal 2,000 years later, is in Egypt and in Crete and in India. And that's it.
And then when the Tigris and Euphrates raise their water level and the Great Flood, we see the Great Flood throughout all the, through a lot of the histories of many peoples around the world.
The whole thing about that Great Flood is quite a puzzle. When they began investigating the actual date lines of flooding levels in Mesopotamia, they were found to be different date lines for different cities. So there's no cosmic flood, you see. The flood motif is also a mythological idea. The whole notion that all originates from water, Mm-hmm. And all is going back to water, the end, gives you a cycle, out of water, back to water, out of water, back to water. And each new cosmic eon, each new world age, is, as it were, a creation out of water and a dissolution into water. So that it's a mythological motif. It's also a psychological motif. When you go to sleep, into deep, dreamless sleep, it's as though you had gone into the sea of night, and then you come out in the day. Local floods then become associated in people's associational imagination with this mythological, psychological flood. The mythological floods are found in practically every people of the world. All along the equatorial belt, up in the north, the American Indians on the Great Plains, where there are many, many flood stories there. And I've just run into a rather amusing context, one that I've known for a long time. The flood has come, and on a raft is Old Man, or the trickster hero, with a bunch of little animals. And to recreate the world, he sends them down to bring mud up from the bottom. Two or three of them die on the way, and finally, let's say, the muskrat comes up with a little bit of mud in his hand, and he then puts it on the water. I mean, the Old Man puts it on the water, pronounces magical words, and the world is brought into being. Now, that story, this that I've given with Old Man, is from the Blackfeet Indians. Throughout the plains areas, you find variants of this. Then you jump over to Siberia, and there it is there. And when you get to areas close to old Russia, you know, Christian Orthodox, East Orthodox Russia, you find the man on the raft is Christ, and the diver is the devil. He sends the devil down to get it. And when he takes the mud out of the devil's mouth, the devil holds some mud in his mouth, and Christ makes it a nice smooth earth, and then the devil spits the mud out, and those are the mountains, and so forth and so on. So there is a flood myth that runs all the way from Central Asia or Western Asia to the American plains. And quite a different flood story, that, from the ones that you'll find, let's say, in Australia or the Tasmanian Islands or the world of Pygmy Africa.
Joseph, I'd like to go back to the alchemy.
Yes, let's do that.
And explore that a little deeper in the relationship of the alchemy of perhaps Roger Bacon, the 13th century, and the alchemy of the 20th century.
Well, the main theme in alchemy is the transmutation of matter, transmuting base matter into gold. And in the texts that have come to us from the 16th, 17th century books of the alchemists, make a point that the gold that they're interested in is not the gold of commerce. It's not the gold of the marketplace. It's the gold of the spiritual fulfillment and realization. And the image of the base matter out of which the gold is to come is comparable, by analogy, to the Christian image of the old Adam and the new Adam, you see. So that the main idea in alchemy is really one of psychological or spiritual transformation, fulfillment, and illumination. Now, mythic themes like that are always rendered in the way of images. And sometimes the images become concretized. That is, say, one interprets the image not as a reference to a spiritual transformation, but to a historical fact or a concrete physical fact. And this is the ambiguity in the whole alchemy thing. There certainly were alchemists who were trying to get physical gold, but always when one reads the texts, the transformations in the retort are associated with visionary images as one contemplates them. And the thing I like to compare it to in my own attempt to understand it all is painting. The artist has a frame that is noncommittal. It's empty. It's kind of void. And he projects into that, in the way of paint, something of his own imaginative creation. And it's important to him whether this color is there in exactly that place and this color over here in exactly that place. And it isn't always just reproducing, as a camera might, a photograph. It's a something of his own spirit that is put forth there, and it bounces back to him in the way of telling his mind something about what his inner spirit is doing. Well, the alchemists used metals and various chemical substances in understanding them only in a very elementary way, in the way the painter uses paint. And his retort, the hermetic retort, sealed by Hermes, the god who gives us the knowledge of immortal life, is, as it were, the canvas. And by dropping certain substances in there and watching them send up mists and things like that, transformation, he's activating his own imagination. And through that, he's bringing up into the field of his consciousness potentials, potentialities from his more unconscious system. And so there's some kind of mysterious thing there. It's really very, very strange. And this wasn't practiced for 500 or so years simply to get gold, which never appeared. There were realizations through this which were what were intended. And they are the realizations of bringing forth the gold from the primal matter. The matter of transformation now, bringing forth the gold of the new human being from the local little primal matter of our different separate civilizations. There is an analogy there.
Organized religion has always seemed to take a dim view of quote, alchemy, unquote. Is that because they take a dim view of the kind of transformation you're talking about?
Well, there was a slightly different theory, do you see, pardon me, underlying alchemy about the world. That's to say, the gold is in the substance of the world. You don't have to bring it in from a savior from without. It's an operation, an in-the-world operation. And many of the institutional religions are more interested in the institution than in the transformation of life. And anything that can affect the transformation outside of the surveillance of the institution is anathema.
Because I recall there were many alchemists in the early centuries, particularly in the Middle Ages, that were persecuted by the church.
Yes, but there were many that were very important philosophers. Albertus Magnus, the master of Thomas Aquinas, was interested in alchemy. And Aquinas himself, a work called Aurora Consurgens of the period of Aquinas, 13th century, is attributed actually to Aquinas, although it may not be his work. But the attribution would never have been made if Aquinas had himself not been interested in alchemy. It is by analogy associated with the salvation of man through the birth of the Christ from the womb of an earthly being. That's the comparable image. Mythology is basically a system of analogies. As gold from base matter, so immortal life from mortal life, so the Christ from Adam, and so forth and so on. And these analogies can be worked, and then the symbols begin to tell you something about the bringing forth of the gold of your own spirit. Now, we spoke of the flood. This contemporary moment with the dissolution of civilizations all around. I mean, as you travel, it's visible all over the place. Everything is disintegrating that was there. That's a flood. Do you see what I mean? And out of the flood comes the new life, the new world. And always, when you have the death image, you have the life image as its counterplayer. These two go together. Where there's a death, there's a birth. And where there's a birth, there's a death. You can't get away from that.
So there's always a bright side, even though it appears to be dark.
Well, it will certainly appear to be dark to those that are holding on to the archaic structure.
Yeah. You know, I think the 13th century keeps coming up, and I think that, you know, I mentioned Roger Bacon was 13th century.
That's right.
The Magna Carta came from the 13th century. The Arthurian legends came from the 13th century. There's so much of that that's still with us here today. Perhaps you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's my view that the period from 1250, from 1150 to 1250, this is the period really of building all of the great early cathedrals in France. It's the period of the Arthurian romances. It's the period of the troubadour. And it, to me, is the seed period of our post-Gothic world, comparable, I think, properly, to the period of the Homeric epics for the classical world. And the echoes of the Arthurian come down to us through many, many transformations. But it was at that time that the germinal formulation of Occidental European spiritual formations and possibilities were stated. The Arthurian romances are the counterparts of the Homeric epics for later Europe. And what is characteristic about them is the faith and trust in the power of the individual to find his own path. There is a sentence that occurs in the Quest of the St. Graal, which is a version of the Grail romance in which Galahad is the hero, that tells us that when the vow was proposed that the Grail quest should be undertaken, Sir Gawain, who was the nephew of King Arthur, stood up and said, I propose a vow that we should go on this quest. And then the text says, they thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest at the point where he had chosen and where it was darkest, and there was no way or path. That's unique to Europe. When you follow a way or path, it's someone else's path. But the European is aware of the individual potentialities unique to each individual. And his life is something he has to find himself. Instruction can come in the way of general guidance, but then it has to be interpreted in terms of a thrust of the individual's own destiny feeling.
It's perhaps the Europeans that felt the strongest about that settled this nation,
settled
America. And
indeed. No way or path they came across, you know. But it's typical of Europe. The whole exploration of the planet which they undertook, no other people had done that with that zeal and enormous result. It's Europe that's transformed this into one planet. Starts with the conquistadores, come over to the Americas. Of course, there's ruthlessness throughout history, and you can't blame any one people for it. Every people has a very dirty history in its relationship to others. Because a peculiar thing about our various mythologies of the past, each of them horizon-bound, is that love is reserved for the in-group, and disdain, hatred, and brutality for the out-group. Every single one. So with this breaking of horizons and the one planet which we see when we look at that picture from the moon, the question comes, what are we going to do with our aggression? How is it going to be absorbed into love, you know, and transmuted from gross matter to gold through the power, really, of human I-thou relationship rather than the I-it which Buber has spoken about?
Do you have any insights on that as to how we're going to do that?
Well, I think the teaching of humanity rather than the teaching of in-group appreciations is what's important.
So the recognition of our connection to other peoples is so important.
But you see what I see, and this is a dismal moment, I think, in this context. I see people pulling back into in-group associations. Just look all around you, what the noise is that's going around. This one, that one, the other one, we're it. And the challenge of the day of opening out to humanity is being ducked, because it means too much giving up of what you have and are sure of. You know, you feel comfortable with your close friends, uncomfortable with people who might have totally different thoughts, afraid to unshell. That's the terrible thing that's going on right now.
So the challenge for the present and the future is to try and build bridges, even though they may be difficult to build.
Yes, you build bridges, but I think the big challenge is an education, an inner education, so that the person is identifying himself with humanity rather than with the in-group. Now, it's not easy, because humanity is a vague concept, and the in-group is what you're experiencing, and love and anxieties and all that come from person-to-person relationships. I think the actual transfer of peoples round about, I mean, the thing that's coming in our country where, I'm in a New York subway, I'm seeing every race in the world. And this is good, except that each of those races is now asking for his own, you know, in-group advantages over the other.
Yeah, it can be mine kind of thing.
Yeah.
That idea.
Yeah, yeah. And we're the ones that deserve it, that sort of thing.
You know, if we go back down through history, and you're an ideal person to go take that journey with, we see conflicts and wars and all throughout history. And we see holy wars. We see religion, the name of religion, the name of God, and the name of conversion. We see such terrible destruction. Mm-hmm. And there are people who say, well, that's human beings' nature to fight with one another, that war is going to be with us as long as human beings are here on the planet. How do you see that?
Well, I think historically that that's not quite true. There have been village raids and that kind of thing in primitive cultures, and then there are some peoples that just like to fight, and they realize that they can get things by plundering people who can't fight as well as they can. You know, there's all that kind of thing. But the real systematic development of civilized warfare began very soon after the rise of the first cities in Mesopotamia. And the first text, real conquest texts, celebrating conquest, not just raiding and hurting somebody and then running off, but taking the land, taking the city, destroying the city, making it yours. This comes along at the time of Sargon I. That's about 2350 B.C. And those texts raise your hair when you read them, how he slew the people of this king's city, that king's city, this king's city, the north, south, east, and west, and this terrible line, and I washed my weapons in the sea. That's his refrain at the end. That's the beginning.
And it just continued on since then.
It just continues. And there are two kinds of warfare that I see just at this quick look backward. One is this imperialistic knocking down the neighbor and washing your weapons in the sea. And the other is the kind of thing that we read of in the book of Judges and Joshua, when a people from a desert area, a bunch of Bedouin nomads, come raiding in on the city. That's the other kind of thing. And that was happening full scale in the third and second millenniums B.C. The Indo-Europeans coming down from the north, the Semites coming out of the Syro-Arabian desert, raiding. Walls are built around cities to defend them against these people, but they can't stand up against them.
Are there any myths of the past that have to do with peace as opposed to conflict? Are there peoples in the past that exhibited a peaceful nature as opposed to a warlike nature?
Well, I think the people of the first cities, the very early cities, and the towns out of which those cities arose, were basically peaceful people. They were agricultural people, and peace was very important for them. And the suffering of war on their part was from the invasions of nomadic, usually herding people, warrior people who liked a good fight. And the first signs of the impingement of those warrior people on the world of the early cities is in the walls that begin to appear in the city, the defending walls. These are people that wanted peace. Then what would happen would be that when they were conquered, the conqueror, who would have been a nomad, you might say, beforehand, would become a master, and he would then start the imperial war. Though the Sargon I was of an invading race, and he starts out and wants more. But the people themselves, the peasant world, the village world, is basically peaceful.
It always seems that when you really get down to the people, when you travel around to other nations, to other countries, when you get down to the people level, people to people, that it seems that people always want to be friends and to have peace. And somehow there's another level, the level of power, the level of control, the level of authority, where there's this quest for more territory, more wealth, more oil, whatever it may be, that has nothing to do, whatever, with the people, but has to do with something else. That's something that exists as much in the present, it seems, as it existed in the past.
Yes, that's certain. But there are two kinds of quest of that kind. One is for the necessities that are substantial to the population itself, you see. And the other is just avidity for more and more and more. But there's this other kind of people, that of these nomads that I'm talking about, that like a good fight. For instance, you and I are the descendants of good old Celts, you know, and they enjoyed it. They would go in a fight stark naked to make it a real tough fight, and they raided all the way down into the Near East and up into Britain and Ireland. And then they settled down. But the Semites from the Syro Arabian desert were that way, too. They were real fighters. They go in. Well, that whole thing about take over Canaan and go in and kill everybody in it, that's fighting stuff.
Yeah.
Well, those aren't peaceful people.
Yeah. Well, do you think it's something that's in people's blood? It's in the genes?
Maybe in certain races. I don't know. Uh-huh. I'm in no position to do more than say that's the way it looks in history, that these people like a fight and these like to sit quiet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a strange thing.
Really?
But the Irish are notorious. Even they couldn't even have a good dinner together without a brawl taking place, you know, in the old epics of the medieval period. In fact, the round table was invented, it is said, so that nobody could claim the first head of the table. That was one way to keep things calm.
One way to keep peace at the table. You know, sir, you've mentioned the city and the origins of the city in Mesopotamia. And I kind of come up to the present and see the city today, particularly the urban environment of our American culture, and how the city has become to violence and crime, and a lot of negative qualities are attributed to the environment. And it's almost like the same walls exist, and the walls hold people in and don't let anything come in or go out. You live in New York. I can enjoy going to New York because I know I can leave. I can go through. Mm. But I can sense and I can have compassion for people who have to live there, who have to live, you know, in a ghetto area with no sunshine, no wildlife, no nature sounds. And I just wonder what you have to say about all of that.
I'm no sociologist.
I know.
And I have very crude standing of what the problems really are.
But I'm just trying to relate from a mythical standpoint the nature of the city.
Well, what I see just in terms of the post is that a lot of people come into the city who are not city people, you see. To me, it's a real pleasure to visit a city where the inhabitants are the descendants of the inhabitants of that city from an older day. They have respect for their city. And you don't see vandalism all over the place as you do in New York today. Then you go to a city like New York or like Calcutta, to which people have come from outside with the hope of getting money or getting something like that. They don't love the city. They didn't build the city. Their parents had nothing to do with the city. They're aliens in the first place, and the city wasn't built to absorb them. And so they become unabsorbed context, you see, with power of its own. And so there's this inevitable kind of mechanical collision here between two systems, the system of people who thought they were going to get become engaged. They are not capable of working in the city very often, you see. They can get only the crudest kind of work, if anything. And I think this is an old story in cities, and it's associated with the cosmopolis, a period that resembles this one, only in a smaller way, is that of the Hellenistic world. After Alexander the Great had gone into India, and the polis broke up, and also the Orient is pouring in, and it's a period of great, great, great disturbance. And it's out of that that the whole new world came, of which the Christian tradition is one manifestation. We're in a similar situation with people pouring in from all around who are not the ones that built the city. They have no love for it, only hate for it, because it did not yield what they thought they were going to get out of it, and then they're kicking at it. There must be some explanation of this wave of impudent vandalism that's evident all over New York. It's terrible, really, and it costs the city millions of dollars. All the monuments desecrated, no respect for them at all. Even such things as park benches deliberately broken up. And, as you know, our subway trains, I don't know.
Multicolored.
Oh, God. And those multicolored things inside the cars, very often right over the maps and everything else to let you know. So just a disregard of the people at all. I don't know what brings that about, but it certainly is a resentment.
Yeah.
A resentment for some reason or other.
Yeah, it just calls up that how it's important that we have respect for the past, and some of us go along blithely, kind of The past is past, it's gone, and we don't really pay it much attention. And yet so much of what's here right now with us can also be found in the past, can be found in mythology, can be found in history.
Yes, well, one of the great books, I think, giving us a clue to what might be called the morphology of history is Spengler's Decline of the West. You know, he really recognized that there is a youth, a maturity, and an old age system in culture cycles. And while one may not agree with the actual datings that he gives, although I tend to do so, one gets the sense of we're moving into old age, our culture, do you see? And the youth was in the Gothic period. The Middle Age was in the great 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And then comes this old age, when what were spontaneous forms of life become problems. Everything's a problem. Marriage is a problem. Birth is a problem. Eating is a problem. You've moved into a cerebral area, and the spontaneity of the body is gone, and the culture's growing old. Now, there are possibilities in old age, as I can tell you, being pretty well along myself. It's a golden, glorious time. There are values and possibilities and knowledges at that time that give life a great, rich quality. But if you're still fighting for place as an old man or an old civilization, you become a nasty, you know. It's too late for that kind of disregard of others.
Yeah, there's a great deal of attention now being given to cults and the nature of cults. And it's interesting because... being an amateur student of history myself, I can go back to the origins of America, and it was really settled by what would be termed cults in a current definition.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm wondering what you have, what light you might have to shed on how you see cults as differentiated from religions. Is there a difference?
Well, Christianity was a cult, certainly in the Roman period, before it became a dominant culture-structuring power. The cult is the beginning of a structure, you know, a little social structure, living, as it were, as a parasite on a already structured society. The intensity of the cult comes from the force of the psychological need to establish relationships that seem significant in a world where the relationships are not significant. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
And so the people are pulled in a very, very deep way. It's almost like the passion of love or lust or something like that. It's a very deeply grounded thing, and people's minds are out of control. It's a natural thing to happen for people who've been utterly deprived of mythologically informed relationships. When one looks at the history of the European city, we spoke of cities, if you were to approach a town, a city in the medieval period, the first highest thing you'd see would be the cathedral. And go to Chartres today in France, that's the first thing you see. When you come then to the princely periods of the 17th and 18th centuries, the most important building was the palace. There's a shift of accent from the religious to the social political. You approach a great city today, what you see are commercial buildings and dwelling buildings. The palace is diminished, and the church even more so. Now, I was in Salt Lake City only a few days ago, and there you have in a microcosm the whole story. That city of Salt Lake City was founded as a religious community. And in the center, the perfect old Chaldean way of doing it, in the center was the temple. And from the temple in the four directions were the main streets, and there they are today. Then there's another building that was built later as the political center, a kind of capital building, and it's higher up than the temple. Second stage. But the big building there now is the office building where the Mormon Church and its own bureaucratic little organization is really operating the system. Fabulous to see the whole thing. But just think of living a life that is governed by political, economic concerns and with no sense of where the cathedral should be or the temple.
It's out of center, you might say. And this is the way our psyches are. But the temple is important. That is to say, the sense of the mystery, the gratitude for being alive, the sense of transcendent energy that unites all of us and all that kind of thing, coordinates our city, coordinates our lives. That's what we've lost. And people, having lost that, go with terrific ferocity for some clue to how to find it again. And that's what the cult is. But the cult does not work as a total city structuring thing. There's another structure principle there. And so people really lose their minds, lose their senses. It's a very easy thing to understand. In the Hellenistic period that I spoke of, you know, all kinds of cults. Christianity was one of them. It finally won through. But there were plenty of others at that time.
And we were talking, you were talking about the individual and emerging from the European culture several centuries ago, and we talked about the discovery of America coming out of that individual consciousness, and then bringing us up to today and the emphasis that there is on certain types of groups, and so much of our society is run by group consciousness. There's the institutions, which essentially are to serve the group, to serve the society. And at the same time, there's the individual struggling for identity and searching for self. Mm-hmm. And then we have the emergence of, quote, the cult. And it's almost like the institutions are cults in themselves. And then you get the institutions coming down on the, quote, cults. And there's all this incredible interplay. And what I see happening is the individual being suppressed or oppressed by all of the group energy, the large group energy. How do you see that, and how is this in history and in myth?
No, that's a fantastic question and observation. I just have to impromptu an answer on that one. I would say that these little groups represent attempts to break out of an archaic institution. I think our religious institutions are archaic. I mean, that just seems to me very clear. And the individual finds himself not at ease within them. And then a clue is offered, I might be at ease here. There are a few, these cults are usually offer simplifications. Do you see what I mean? As though life could be much simpler than all that. Many of them think of going away, well, that one of the last degree, yeah. Going away, our place, and sitting old thing. This was all of the 19th century in America. There were a lot of these things, and no Mormonism is one also we have been speaking about. Individual not able to do anything alone. Life's in a relationship. And even though one is living an individual life, not following the formulae of the past, one has to have some kind of companionship and response, echo, and the cult seems to offer it to people. And many of the people in cults are not greatly individuals themselves. Anyhow, they don't have the courage of their own individuality. They follow the lead of someone who seems to be an individual. That is respect for the individual, you might say, It's just too bad that possibility of fulfillment doesn't come out of these things. They are all in-group things again. You know, we're special, we got the message, and the world is inferior, evil, or one thing or another. The answer isn't there.
So part of it, it seems to me, is in looking for the answer, if there is an answer, is the recognition that there is a connection among all of us, and there's a connection. The beauty, it seems to me, of mythology is that it shows the connection so much of the time. I mean, we see the same motif in one culture, and then we move across the planet, and there it is again, and there it appears again. And there's that connection constantly that comes up all mm-hmm. the time. And it seems that the lessons from the past are not being learned in the present.
Well, the main drift of mythology, I mean, if you want to put it into a sentence or two, is that this separateness that is apparent in the phenomenal world is secondary. Beyond and behind and within and supporting that is a seen but experienced unity and identity as all. It's love you recognize that family. Then the level of unity is of the tribe, say, or the social unit. But beyond that is a common human identity. And there's this wonderful saying of Schopenhauer, this question of Schopenhauer's that I like to bring up. How is it that an individual, a human being, can so participate in the danger and pain of another that, forgetting his own self-protection, he flies spontaneously, he moves spontaneously to the other's rescue, even at the cost of his own life, you see? Schopenhauer's answer is that this is a metaphysical realization that is showing its force, namely the realization that you and that other are one. And the sense of separateness is simply a function of the way we experience things in space and time. You see what I mean? Now, the spontaneity of that going to rescue, I think, would jump culture lines. If you were to see someone of a totally alien world, even a person of a race or nation that you had no sympathy for, I think the spontaneity of the recognition would take place. And the ultimate reference of mythology is to that single entity, which is the human being as human, underlying all the separate manifestations of the human being.
So we almost have to go beyond rational thought to catch that connection.
This is irrational, you see. That's the point. All compassion, all sympathy is irrational. The rational is always stressing I, thou, opposites. I see you, you see me. This other thing says, oh, no. I mean, those movements that come in the spirit from the heart and all, those are totally irrational. Love is irrational.
Yeah. It's beyond the mind, beyond the...
Absolutely. Beyond. The mind is in the world of separateness. And the mind also is in the world of angular structures. Do you see what I mean? It's all put together, and you can add it up, and it comes out mathematically. This other thing jumps the mathematics.
You know, recently... my stepson happens to be going to taking a world history class, and his group was studying Peru, and his group was the Spanish group, and so he got into Peru, and so I kind of got an opportunity to recover my own interest in Peruvian South America culture and so forth, and just again looked at the devastation that the Spaniards wrought when they came to America, and you know, destroying these incredibly beautiful cultures, the Aztecs, the Incas, the Mayans. Mm. And there was a scene that is related where the friar that had accompanied Pizarro on his expedition showed Atahualpa the Bible. This is God. And Atahualpa couldn't deal with it. It wasn't that, how could God be in this this material object? It was so beautiful, the message that was there. And I guess the reason I brought that up is just the nature of conflict goes back to that perhaps is related to that inability to go beyond the mind, that to recognize the connection that we all have, and somehow we get in the way of that by saying, this is mine and that's not yours.
That's
and,
right. But then the opposite problem comes up when one becomes too strongly linked to the commonality and losing touch with one's own individuality, because part of our loyalty to life is being loyal to our own lives, you know, not sacrificing oneself, but letting oneself play in relation to the other in a prudent and positive way.
Striking the balance, as the Buddha said, the middle path.
Well, yes, and there's this little verse from the Rig Veda that I'm very much attached to, of the tree of life, and two birds on the tree, fast friends. One eats the fruit of the tree, and the other, not eating, watches. And those are two aspects of ourselves. And one, we eat the fruit of the tree. We kill a life in order to eat it. And we win, and we play the world of action. But then in contemplation, do you see, as the meditative one, we are removed from the destiny of the one who is killing and winning and losing. I think of a tennis match where in the field, on the court, one is on one side of the net, and there wouldn't be a game if one didn't play that game hard, you know, against the other one. But also there is the referee who doesn't care who wins. And a good sport is one who can hold both positions. You're playing the game as hard as you can, but you're a good loser. Do you see what I mean?
Sure.
And it's those two positions, the general one that looks at at the duality of the field, you mustn't say that should not be, because if it wasn't there, there wouldn't be any life. And yet you participate on one side. That's part of participating in life. That's part of the participation in the sorrows of life, the cruelties of life and all that. There's a Buddhist formula for the bodhisattva, for the one who has illumination but determines to remain in the world. All life is sorrowful. So the bodhisattva participates with joy in the sorrows of the world, suffering himself in the world. This is the crucified one who came to be crucified. You know, the crucifixion is not something that should not have happened.
Joseph, I want to publicly acknowledge you for editing this marvelous book called The Portable Jung. It's an incredible selection of the works of Jung, and I think anyone can pick it up and get a fairly good idea of where Jung was coming from. And it gives me an opportunity to ask you, I know that Jung has had an effect on your own work and your own life, mm-hmm. and I'd like to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first interest in the world that I'm interested in was in mythology. It grabbed me when I was very young, and one mythology after another took over. And when I was a student then, a graduate student in Germany, back in 28-29, I discovered for myself the works of Freud and Jung. And this opened up a psychological dimension in a field that I had no knowledge of in those terms. And suddenly I realized why the subject was interesting to me, and a lot of new mysteries and wonders came through. Now, Jung was not known very well in the United States at that time. I think there were two small translations of works that he had published. Freud was well known, only I had not been a student of psychology and didn't know Freud. So both of these men began to talk to me, you might say, and inform me about one aspect of my own subject. I now realize that one aspect of the subject is the psychological mystery, and the other aspect is the historical and ethnographical side of the show. So on the psychological side, these two men played back and forth in my thinking. When I did The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which was back in the 40s, middle and early 40s, they were a sort of equal in my thinking, and Freud served in one context and Jung in another aspect of my interpretation of myths. But then the years following that book, Jung became more and more eloquent to me. I think the longer you live, the more Jung can say to you. And I go back to him, and things that I've read are saying new things. Freud never says a new thing to me anymore. It always comes out, you know, Oedipus and a few things like that. And I get bored with that. And my feeling is that Freud tells us what myths mean to neurotics. And Jung gives us a clue to how to let the myth talk to us in its own terms without putting a formula on it. And so I've been with Jung, you might say, for, well, now, since 1928. That's a long, long spell.
Yeah.
And as I say, he means more and more and more to me. Now, for me, he's not the final word at all. I don't think there is a final word. But he has opened me up to prospects and vistas that are of his work. Now, there's one other thing. In my life came Heinrich Zimmer, who was a great Indologist and a genius with respect to the interpretation of symbols. And he is, in my mind, supplementary to Jung. They were close friends for the last years of Zimmer's life. In fact, Jung edited Zimmer's German of Posthuma, as I edited Zimmer's English. So when I met Jung, we were, you know, co-editors. Zimmer was kind of nice. And so those two men are the ones that talked to me.
Yeah. What was he, you had personal interaction with Carl Jung. What was he like as a person?
Oh, this was a magnificent man. And he was no Herr Doctor Professor. He was playing it all the time. And we did not talk about subjects in which he was an authority, you know. We were ad-libbing rather a fresh conversation. It was just a tea that my wife and I had with Dr. Jung and Mrs. Jung at Bollingen, which is his place on the Lake of Zurich. at the other end of the lake from Zurich itself, in that marvelous little castle he built with his own hands, you know, that stone thing on the lake. And we were greeted when we arrived and sat there by the lake in genial, easy conversation. He was a big, magnificent man. And my wife tells me that his eyes were very attractive. It was fun.
Yeah. Have you, in your own studies of mythology, found, have verified any of, like, the collective unconscious is one thing that, have you found that to be... a motif throughout mythology?
What are you going to do with the fact that the same motifs appear everywhere? They do. There's a constellation of motifs, basic motifs in mythology, that are fundamental. How do you explain it? It's come from the same zone as dreams. So the individual dreams and your dream won't be like mine, let's say. But here we come to a level of what might be called racial dreams, the myths. And they match, they match, they match. And the word collective unconscious, or you might say general unconscious, is a term just to recognize that fact, and that there is a common humanity built into our nervous system out of which our imagination works. The appeal of these constants is very deep, generally human. Now, the explanation that is often given in the Freudian circles of individual experiences, you know, being the source of dream, biography, not biology, you see, and different racial histories being the source of their myths, that won't explain it. That just won't. It doesn't fit. It may say something about a certain inflection or aspect or peculiar thing about this particular mythology as against that one. Why does this group have one god, and that god is the god of their little society, you know, with them as the special people, and this group doesn't think that way? Their deities have to do with the world of nature, you know? What is it gives those different pitches to these different culture systems? That's special history and biography. But what about the big general humanity? We all have, you can recognize a human being no matter where you see him. And so he must have the same kind of nervous system, basically. Therefore, his imagination must work out of a comparable base. And so what's so goddamn mystical about all that? That just seems to me to be obvious.
Yeah.
And that's what the term collective unconscious is supposed to cover.
Joseph, you're always a delight. I get carried away on clouds of my own imagination as I listen to you.
Well, I find myself in invisible battle with some people, you know.
it does seem that Jungian psychology, it does seem to be a little more open than other more traditional forms or other traditional forms
well, you
of psychology.
Know, for some people... Jungian is a nasty word, and this has been flung at me by certain reviewers as though it just said, well, don't bother with Joe Campbell, you know, he's a Jungian. I'm not a Jungian. As far as interpreting myths, Jung gives me the best clues I've got, but I'm much more interested in diffusion and relationships historically than Jung was, do you see? Very, very much, so that the Jungians think of me as a kind of questionable person, and I don't use those formula words very often in my interpretation of myths, but it gives me the background from which to let the myth talk to myself. But Timmer, I think, was my final guru, you might say, the one that really gave me the courage to interpret myths out of what I knew of their common symbols and so forth and so on. There's always a risk there. But it's the risk of one's own personal adventure, you might say, instead of just gluing yourself to what someone else found.
You brought up my next subject by mentioning Heinrich Zimmer as one of your gurus.
Yes. And
that is the emergence of other cultural traditions, other forms into our own culture,
yes.
Namely this one, and the appearance of gurus, the appearance of teachers,
yes.
From other traditions, other religious forms. And I know that your own work has been influenced heavily by Buddhism and Hinduism, mm-hmm. and the models and the myths that are there. Mm-hmm. And you've done a beautiful job of translating them in a number of your books. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this transmigration of cultures as we see the East come to the West, and we hear the word synthesis, we hear the word of East and West coming together? How do you see that, and what do you think is the vision for the future of that? Are we moving towards something new, or are we going to synthesize the best from the East, the best from the West, and create something new, or are we going to go with old models? How is it going to happen?
Well, I don't think there can be a general synthesis of East and West, but there can be special syntheses in different places. I think what the West absorbs from the East is going to be one thing. What the East absorbs from the West is going to be something else, and it will differ from region to region. The Chinese are not going to want the same things that the Indians want. I don't mean only want, but need, in the way of spiritual food from the West. The West has spiritual food to give, and a lot of it, not just gadgets, you know. Now, I can't talk about what's happening in India because I'm not an Indian, and I look at it from outside, or China or Japan, although I'm very fond of the Japanese situation, and I admire enormously what they're doing with our Western things. But they're still Japanese. Now, I can say something about the East coming to the West, particularly in the field of religions and mythology. Our Western systems, from way back, but particularly from the 4th century in the period of Theodosius, have been institutionalized. Our mythologies are institutionalized, and salvation comes from membership in an institution. You see this sign all over the New York subways, go to church, you know, read the Bible. Well, that has to do with one definition of a religious life. You can't find it in yourself. You find it only through the church. The East, these men from the East come, whether they are Indians or Japanese or Tibetans, and they tell us the real mystery is in yourself. Well, we have that in our tradition. The kingdom of heaven is within you. Who's in heaven? God's in heaven. Where's God? Within you. That's not what the church advertises, you might say. God is in the tabernacle, you know, or the church or something like that. And this thing that the Orient is bringing is a realization of the inward way. When you sit in meditation with your hands in your lap looking down, that means you've gone in, and you're coming not just to a soul that is disengaged from God, you're coming to the divine mystery right there in yourself. That's what the East is teaching us. That was in the Christian tradition. And we find it in the Gospel according to Thomas, which has been dug up out of the Egyptian desert, you know, in 1948. But it has been pushed out. The mystical, the truly mystical finding of the divine, not only within you, but within all things, is not favored by either the Jewish or the Christian or the Muslim traditions. These are institutional religions. And I think the big thing that the Orient is bringing to us, the mysteries inside yourself. And that's that saying from the old Chandogya Upanishad from about the 9th or even perhaps 10th centuries B.C., Tatvamasi, you are it. That divine mystery that you seek to know is the very source of your own life. It is the being of your beings, and find it within.
So there's the mythical attraction, and at the same time, we see gurus gathering disciples about them, and people essentially, you know, changing perhaps their lifestyle, their habit of clothing, etc., and in following a master, a teacher, a guru. How about that?
Well, there are two responses that are quite natural, I think, to the guru. When anyone becomes a model for you, you tend automatically to imitate him. Little boys imitate their fathers. It's darling to see a little boy walks just like his father, you know, some little kid like that. And this is the spontaneous identification. It's through that identification that something's developing in you. So that's the first phase, let's say. But the second phase is to find your own self. And I think the wearing, for instance, of Oriental clothes, or even assuming of Oriental names, this is not correct. It's displacing you again. You see, you have mistaken the clothing for the message. And not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, you know, is going to get to the kingdom of heaven. Not everyone who wears a turban is a released spirit. So that's one way to get caught. caught again, then you mistake a certain attitude or manner of looking and life and living. And even such things as food taboos and all that, picking up all that stuff, that has nothing to do with the spiritual life. I've heard of a couple of Rishis over here whose first statement is, if you want illumination, you've got to be an American, not a Japanese. I mean, to make believe you're Japanese is just to run off on a detour and get stuck in the woods. It's not in the manner of dress as on speech. It's in the manner of experience and illumination. And so I think the guru thing it can be a delusion, but everything can be a delusion thing. You got to get it the right way. And some of the gurus I know, and I think they take advantage of people that way. You know, they love to have the adulation that comes with that kind of imitation, and also it gives them a kind of authority. The thing about the guru in the West is that he represents an alien principle of the spirit, namely that you don't follow your own path, you follow a given path. The great guru in the traditional culture assumes the moral responsibility for his student's life. He tells him what he's to do. My God, that's totally contrary to the Western spirit. And our spirituality is that of the individual quest, the individual realization, authenticity in your life out of your own center. You see? That's not Oriental. So one has to take this message from the East, assimilate it to one's own dimension and to one's own thrust of life, not get pulled off. And wearing an Oriental costume is the first sign of pulled off the track. You're following someone else's path.
Joseph, a famous statement is, in wildness is the preservation of the world. And it's just occurring to me as we're talking, the connection that I always feel, and all of us feel, when we get in touch with nature and wildness and the wilderness. And I go back to what we were talking about, the cities, and how in the city, most cities, nature is removed. It's not there anymore. And so much of mythology deals with human beings' connection with the earth, with nature, with the world, the environment around us. And to some extent, perhaps our environmental problems of today are partly due to the fact we've gotten out of touch with the environment we live in. I want you to talk about just the relationship of environment through mythology to... Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to think first and realize first that the human being is a biological phenomenon himself. He's a product of nature. And he has this body, which is like the body of the grass or the trees, a product of this good earth. And on the other hand, in contrast to the trees and the grasses and the little bugs, he has this great brain up here, which has a structuring character that is not that of nature. It has its own almost mathematical kind of thinking. Rational thinking is let's say rectangular, whereas the body thinking is circular. These are the two kinds of consciousness that are right in us. One is that which the Indians call the Vijnanamaya Kosha, the sheath of wisdom, the wisdom that's digesting our meals, you know, and that brings the grass up, and that we share with the whole world of nature. But then there's this Manomaya Kosha, this intelligence, this of the brain, which has plans for how life should be. And it's not always the way life wants to be. So there's a conflict between these two worlds. I think of it really in the way of the city, particularly a city like New York. San Francisco is a little different because on these hills you can see the nature world, you know. But in New York you're in those canyons. And when you see the moon over New York City, you just are amazed. There's another nature world. So the mind may be very well at home in New York, but this other, the body, the other support to the mind, which is the nature of biology, is out of accord with that. And then you go out into even Westchester County, you know, just a suburb area, and you begin to feel, the body says, here's where I belong. These are my friends. Now, the tendency in our culture, you see, is to be more and more of this mathematical organization instead of the organic. And the interaction between these two is what keeps us civilized and harmonious human beings. Now, there are two things to be said. One is, in wilderness is the salvation. Yes, if that's wiped out, we're nothing but mechanical. But the next thing is that the whole function of myth is to unite these two orders of our nature, the mental nature, the waking consciousness nature, and that thing that takes over in sleep. When people have nightmares, it's principally because they have been repressing the biology, you know, and it comes up with a vengeance. The deity that is disregarded turns into a devil, becomes negative. And nature then becomes feared if it has been suppressed long enough and you're out of accord with it, because of course it always is going to break up the quadrangular mode of planning that you've had for your life. Break, falling in love, there's nature coming, and my God, it's a wreck of many a program.
Yeah.
And the nature world, the wilderness world, it's a wonderful thing to meet, but then we've got to have the other one too, you see. Yeah.
Western technology, I mean, the Industrial Revolution has mostly come from the place of overcoming nature, overcoming natural causes. And if we go back before the Industrial Revolution, in fact, we don't even have to go back before that. We can look at other cultures in other parts of the world where the natural environment is very much a part of their daily life. And somehow there's been an imbalance in our own culture where we've lost that.
Yes, and the irony of it all is, you know, the science really comes from paying attention to nature. It takes the possibilities of nature and recombines them, but it bases nature too. And then there are two natures, really, which one could experience by being up in an airplane, you know, up in, 30,000 feet and that kind of thing, at sunset time or at dawn time. You realize that there is a nature of these great physical phenomena, rainbows and all that kind of thing, as well as the nature of the trees and the plants, that the organic nature. There's this other one. That's a nature too, and that's the nature that our science, I think, is bringing in, the nature of the physical rather than the organic world.
Yeah.
But it's part of nature, even as our brain is.
Right, right. Do you have any insights just about how we as individuals can recover our contact with nature?
I think that's just a question of life planning. That you should put yourself in a situation so that you will have that refreshment from time to time. Even just having a house in the country, you know, to which you can go weekends or where you can spend the two-week holiday or something like that. But if in your weekend or holiday you keep yourself in the world of enclosed civilized living, then the nature is becoming starved inside you. And that's just individual planning, I think.
Yeah, my next question is related to what we've been talking about and how we've gotten out of balance. And I think you have something to say about this. And that is the quest for right living, the quest for doing something that's harmonious with our life. And again, looking at our society and again looking at the past and from a mythical standpoint, that now we're in a place where usually most of our work is separated from our life. There are all these dichotomies. There are these splits built in. And yet if we look at history, if we look at the past, we can see that those people who got along the best seem to be those people who had a unity in their life, that their work was part of their life, that it was unified. And now we have the splits. How do you see that?
Well, again, I can look at it only in terms of an individual. And I think the individual who takes a job in order to live for the money or something like that, he's turned himself into a slave. He's a money slave. And you might say work, it begins where you don't like what you're doing. I heard a little formula way, way back, make your hobby your source of income. Then there's no such thing as work. And there's no such thing as getting tired. And it's been my own experience. I did just what I wanted to do. It takes a little courage at first, because who the hell wants you to be doing just what you want to do? They've all got a lot of plans for you. But you can make it happen. And then there's no such thing as work. The people say, when do you take a holiday? Well, a holiday's often just a bore, because I'm not doing what I really want to do. I think that it's a very important thing for a young person to have the courage to do what seems to him significant in his life, and not just take a job in order to make money. But this takes a bit of prudence and very careful planning and so forth, and may delay some of your achievements in the field of money and earning and comfortable living. But the ultimate result will be very much to your pleasure.
Going back to the search for the Holy Grail and the individual quest, and again, looking at current contemporary times, we have this incredible pressure of the group saying, do it this way, do it that way. What do you mean you don't have a job? What do you mean you're doing it that way? This is the way to do it. Yeah. There's all this pressure that inhibits the individual search for one's own Holy Grail.
I know there is, but there's an awful lot of margin, too. There are plenty of ways to coast along until you find your center. I don't mean going on relief. I don't want to say anything about that. I don't have much respect for people who could do something, who go on that, or who has the society support you while you're finding your feet. There are other ways to work that one out. But if you have a job, and it takes so much of your time, and at the same time you do have enough time left to do the development of your own system of ideas for the future, whatever it's going to be, and then the boss says, "Well, if you work 2 hours more, I'll give you more money." Then you say, "No." Do you see what I mean? The acceptance of the popular advancement is often to the detriment of one's career work. And the thing that comes in writing when people say, every writer has to make this kind of decision, I'll write potboilers until I got enough money to write. You're not going to write the one that you want to write when the time comes, because you've learned to write potboilers. Your right hand with the pencil is working from that level instead of from the other one.
Yeah.
So it's an early decision of courage to do the thing that it's your authentic drive. I think that's the path where there's no path, you know. So
dive into the deep water.
The gateless gate.
The unmapped.
Take the rap. But I found, I don't know how it is right now, because my days were a long way back, but in the 20s and 30s, there were plenty of marginal areas where you could incubate your destiny. I think they must still exist. I know a few of them.
Continuing that thread of getting more harmony in our lives,
yeah.
And I think of going back to our conversation about nature and recovering that harmony as well, and just understanding our environment in deeper and more meaningful kinds of ways so that we can lead more fulfilling lives. I think of what we're learning now. I think of the Castaneda books, where he explored the myths of the shaman, and we have this recovery, as it were, of some of the deeper insides of the Central American and South American cultures that mm-hmm. have been lost for so many years, and part of that recovery is that connection to the earth. And that right living unity and harmony that seems inherent in these people's lives. And I wanted to kind of bring up the shaman, which is I think is a mythical figure, and perhaps have you talk about that a little bit, as to the importance of the shaman and the role of the shaman in life.
Well, I think the shaman is primarily associated with early hunting cultures. There are in the caves in France, you know, Lascaux and Pechmel and all those, a number of representations of shamans in action, in work, and doing their work. And then the next stage of our knowledge of the shaman is in the north. the Siberian peoples and among many of our North American Indian tribes. Primarily, the shaman is the religious man of a hunting culture. And he is one who, typically at adolescence or early puberty, has had what would be diagnosed today, I imagine, as a schizophrenic crack-up. And he has gone into the world of the unconscious and its powers, its demons, and its deities. And he is brought out of that by the ministrations of an older shaman who gives him the mythic instruction and the disciplines to function as a shaman. The shaman is typically one who is called by unconscious powers. And everything one reads of these let one know that a shaman, one who has been called and refuses the call, has a real hard time. He's going to have a hard time anyhow. And he becomes the spiritual presence in his culture world. It's an individualistic experience, do you see? Later, in agriculturally based societies, the shaman is in a secondary position. The figure in the main position there is the priest. And the priest is an ordained official for the tribal or village deities and cults. These are not his personal experiences. Do you see what I mean? And he is in the service of the society and its deities. And for the priestly society, the shaman is an archaic danger. You see, the shaman represents really a kind of early mystic, one who's had the individual mystic experience. And he is supported by his familiars, his own special deities, whereas the priest is supported by the, and is the supporter of, the tribal or village or culture deities. This is a conflict.
It's the book versus the experience.
The priest is the man of the book, and the shaman the man of the experience. Now, of course, in the priestly culture, we also have mystics who are the counterparts in the higher culture system to the shaman. Now, with the insecurity that we feel with respect to our religious institutions, you see, there's a kind of drift to the shamanic ideal. But that came in, I think, in too strong a way in the period of the 60s when people were taking the LSD and going bing-bang down there too fast without the proper mythological rescue crew to pull them out again, if you see what I mean. The traditional description of shamans is that it's a real tough time, and they need a lot of help getting out.
Yeah. And in the context of shamans, I think of heroes, and it's almost like the shaman is someone that the community can look to for support in times of stress.
Yes.
And in our society, one of the things that it seems that's been lost is the notion of the hero. We constantly search for the person who's going to pull us out. We look to the presidency as, you know, the president's going to take care of it. Congress is going to take care of it. Somebody's going to take care of it. And in all of this, it's like the hero of the past, the knight in the white charger, is somehow not appearing as we supposed he would.
Well, I think there are two aspects of the hero. One, the hero is somebody whom you can lean on and who's going to rescue you. And the other is the hero is an ideal for your own life. For you to live the heroic life, and that's the life of the individual adventure, really. Now, one of the problems today is that with the enormous transformations of the forms of our lives, the models for life don't exist for us. Do you see? In a traditional society and an agriculturally based city world, there were relatively few life roles, and the models were there for them, do you see? And then there was a hero for each life role. But now just look what has come along in the past 20 years in the way of new life possibilities and requirements and all of that, and we don't have the models. The hero as model is one thing, and we lack them. So each one has to be his own hero and find through this following of the path that's no path, yes, what the model of his life is. It's a very interesting situation.
or at least the models that we tend to use are very strange ones indeed. I mean, I think of Hollywood stars.
Oh, now there's that, of course. These models come flashing in front, and there are heroes. I don't know how it is in San Francisco with the newspapers, but when I go into the subway and see people reading newspapers, they're reading the back pages where the sports are, and you have all these sport heroes. I think the athletic hero is right there in front of us, largely for people who can hardly throw a ball. You know, they're no athletes. That's a bizarre kind of hero, just one that you can't really incorporate in your life. Other heroes are a movie and actor heroes, stage personalities, political personalities. But it's a pity that they're mostly heroes in life contexts that are not those of the people who are admiring them. Do you see what I mean? The individuals don't have models. That's just a curious result of the fact that our society is changing so fast. But I think there are heroes. There's just no doubt about it. I think Martin Luther King was a hero. I think Kennedy was a hero. Both Kennedys who were shot there, and certain athletes certainly.
They filled the model.
They filled the model, but they're not doing much for us in the way of helping us to build our own lives. There are very few models for life. I think the individual has to find his own model. I found mine.
Yes.
This professor, this teacher, this one that gave me the clue to what a life path would lead to if it went in his direction.
Isn't it very important to give respect to our own uniqueness and our own individuality?
I think that's the most important thing of all.
Yeah.
That's why I was bringing up in connection with the guru who asked you to follow his way. I don't think you can do that.
Yeah, it amazes me, though. And, you know, again, we're in an age of modern communication where we can hear what's going on the other side of the planet instantaneously, literally. We're surrounded by pressures that, again, take us away from our own uniqueness, our own individuality. And again, each of us is really different. And going back to the mythical quest, it's recovering that quest in ourselves that's so important, and not looking outside to the other models, the role models, as it were, but getting back to that individual, deeper side of ourselves.
Yeah, that's it. But getting our models from all over the world by TV and all of that, we're pulled off from our own culture line, too. And there are a lot of distractions in the world today.
Like we're really here for a reason.
Yeah.
In this place at this time.
Well, you may find out what a good reason would be at any rate. You can't say that somebody put the reason on you, but you can find one out of yourself. You decide what the meaning of your life is to be. When people talk about what is the meaning of life, there's no meaning of life. There are lots of meanings of different lives, and one must decide what one wants one's own to be.
You mentioned the different lives. It just brings up the question of reincarnation. Is that something that appears throughout mythology?
Only in certain mythologies. The most primitive mythologies have the idea that the dead do come back in the grandchildren or something like that. That's just a non-developmental reincarnation, you know what I mean? Well, it was, I think, probably out of India that the idea came of a sequence of lives, each life being a kind of schooling, you know, and the next life, then you graduate to the next scale and so forth, so that there is a kind of progression from one life to another in whatever may be thought to be illumination. In the West, where you have the one life idea, there's a totally different psychology associated with that. The Indian idea that the reincarnating monad puts on bodies and puts them off, as a man puts on and puts off clothing, makes the accent on the hero, that reincarnating monad, not the personality, but where you live one life, where you are it, you know, it's a totally different attitude toward life. The life is much more deeply respected. It is much more of a significant concern that you should live it in terms of its unique and unrepeatable possibilities.
You know, Joseph, in these closing minutes, we've covered such a wide range of content here. I can't encompass
it
all
together.
But you know, I was thinking of we've covered some deep things and some very meaningful things. And I kind of want to balance the heaviness or with the lightness, and I want to talk about the role of the fool in our life, and how we all need to get in touch with that one too, don't we?
Yes. Well, that again, in primitive hunting cultures, that's the trickster hero, and the trickster hero he represents all those possibilities of life that your mind hasn't decided it wants to deal with. Mind structures a lifestyle, and the fool or the trickster is the one who represents another whole range of possibilities. He doesn't respect the values that you've set up for yourself and smashes them. And so the fool became really the instructor of kings. You know, the king would have his joker beside him. And he was careless of the king's opinion, careless of the king's power, and the king allowed this to be because he got wisdom from this non-controlled, uncontrolled source. The fool is the breakthrough of the absolute, you might say, into the field of the controlled social orders.
To some extent, we've lost our Courtchesters.
Well, some of our journalists are real Courtchesters, I think, without knowing it. But that's true. And in the tarot pack, of course, the fool at the end of the series and runs through all the series represents the one who's gone through all the initiations, all the stages that are represented in that series of cards, and now can wander through the world up and down the mountains with the lion roar of illumination, careless and fearful of nothing.
Joseph, that thought just kind of reminds me of you.
Well, that's sweet. I really like to hear that. I like to be the wandering fool.
As always, it's been a beautiful time. I've really enjoyed being with you.
Well, I always enjoy it, Michael. I'm looking forward to the next already.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. I've been talking with Joseph Campbell, the author of so many books. If you haven't seen The Mythic Image, that is an incredible book in itself, a wonderful story of mythology. The Portable Jung is another great one, too. In any case, I'm sure you can find Joseph Campbell's books in most bookstores. This is Michael Toms, wishing you happy myths.